nuclear weapons.
But how would they have been relevant and perhaps changed the outcome?
Yeah, you could have taken a nuclear broom and swept out North Vietnam. I'm just saying that we had the physical capability to solve.
The outcome wouldn't be the same? I mean,
no, it certainly wouldn't have been the same. The question is whether it would have been better or not. And I'm not arguing it would have been better. I'm just saying that we had the sheer destructive power that we did not, no one had in earlier wars or previous wars to command an outcome. Actually, I mean, if you want to talk in these terms, it would have been possible, I think, just with a couple of demonstrations to... the people in Hanoi were not mad. They were not going to sacrifice everybody and everything for the sake of it. So I think all it would really have taken was the credible threat to use nuclear weapons. But it was judged that this could not be done because of the effects this would have around the world, which would have been extreme, no question about it. And you understand, I'm not advocating this. I'm simply saying that there was a theoretical possibility in which the physical power that you had could have been used to effect a different ending.
But so many of the things that we talk about show that all of this power...
Yeah, but you're just talking about suicide now. You're saying to the North Vietnamese, do you guys want to commit suicide or not? And if you can establish that with credibility, their answer is going to be no. You're not crazy. You know, we may be determined. I think that's exactly what happened in the end of World War II in Japan. The Japanese had every intention of fighting on. And then what you presented them with was suicide, really. It was also, in the case of the Japanese, I think an excuse that they were very happy to take. But if we had not had the bomb, I think the end of the World War II would have been quite different, much more bloody, and much more bloody to the Japanese. I mean, there have been deaths would have been higher on their side than it would have been on ours. But if there had been an ordinary landing and an ordinary battle for Japan, are you reading me what I'm saying here or not? I'm never sure with you.
I'm not sure you heard the one point I was making, that I think possibly the communists still might have maintained South Vietnam, even if the war was gone.
Well, I think the argument is that, no, you put a gun to somebody's head and they're going to, unless they're mad, are going to do whatever it is you want as long as that gun is pointing to their head. I mean, that's, to me, not political science, it's just common sense. If they don't believe you, or they want to call your bluff, yeah, then it's a different matter. But that simply is a matter of credibility. I'm assuming that they believe that you're going to do what you say you are, or you even start doing it, which is what we did in Japan. You know, one on Hiroshima, one bomb, and we learned later, they figured we only had one. And actually, we had two. but then came Nagasaki, and that was a bluff, and we said, we've got all kinds of these. We didn't. It had taken us probably a year or two to produce another one. But, they couldn't afford to call that bluff because they were rational people, as anybody would have done in these circumstances. All right. Yes. Yeah, you know, it's harder, somewhat harder to build this case, and this was what some South Vietnamese, Minh Cao Ki particularly, wanted to march north, wanted to, by ordinary land warfare, or Incheon landing, kind of amphibious landing, say above or below Vinh, cut the country in half and so on. You have to really be a an expert military analyst to try to determine this. I put it to Westmoreland once. I used to see him occasionally and tell him about what I thought he should know about North Vietnam. And so one, this was usually at his house at night, and I'd just come over and have coffee and so on. I mean, it'd just be the two of us, and we kind of informal. So at one point, there was a great deal of talk about marching north. And Nguyen Cao Ky, as I say, was pushing this very much. And what he wanted was to do what MacArthur had done in the Korean War, that is, land above, as they did at Incheon, a land above the enemy, and you've got your forces coming up, and then you cut them off, and you squeeze them, and so on. And it worked brilliantly in Korea. Apparently, MacArthur took a terrible chance in doing this. Could have blown up, and you know, everything had gone wrong. But it worked, so you know, it's hard to knock a winner. Anyway, this is what Key wanted to do. So I said to Westmoreland, you know, would you mind telling me, you know, I hear all this talk about how we should march north and how we should have an Incheon landing, and other people say this doesn't make sense, or it isn't appropriate, or it wouldn't work, or and so on. So would you explain to me what is the truth of this? And so he began drawing diagrams and listing statistics on ships that are involved. He begins way back at the Dieppe raid in World War One or Two, which was the first amphibious landing the Allies made in Europe. It was an experiment. They landed at Dieppe, put some commandos ashore, and they were trying to find out how many ships do you need, how many, you know, all the logistics and guns and everything you need. Put X number of people ashore and to keep them supplied and to make the thing work. And what happened, they found in Dieppe raid, it was a complete disaster for the Allies. Everything went wrong and it was just a terrible mess. But they kept saying, well, we learned a great deal from this, which I suppose they did. Anyway, he begins with that point, is that to an amphibious landing is the most difficult landing to make. It's the most difficult to support. The dangers for enemy counterattack are the greatest, and it's the hairiest of all kinds of any kind of action you can take in warfare. So then he began to tick off how many forces we would need, how many troops we'd have to land, how many ships we'd need to keep them supplied, and it comes down to we would have to gut the whole U.S. naval strength in Asia and the whole Pacific Basin to support this thing for 6 weeks. Everything we'd have to be there, and it all have to work. And his answer, of course, was that this is not feasible to do. Now, I've always had trouble with that, and I've tried this out on other military minds who say that's not really true. It wasn't that hard. It could have been done easier. But you see, what you get into are logistics. You get into tonnages, how many tons of supplies you need for this type of soldier on the ground, how much for that kind of soldier. It's very complicated. And you know, a civilian like me can just get lost in no time at all. So I still don't know for sure whether Westmoreland was... I think Westmoreland was what he told me he believed himself. He just believed this was foolish adventurism to talk in these terms, and he was trying to talk Lyndon Johnson out of it and try to win Cao Ky out of it and talk me out of it, I guess, to the extent that I at least raised the question.
At the point when Westmoreland had the power to participate something like that, I always thought that...
Well, in the early years, we kept saying that we will not carry the war into enemy territory, will not make the mistake. This is the old business of fighting the last war rather than the next war. The fear was that if you move over the 17th parallel, you'll do what happened when he went over the 38th parallel in Korea, that is, bring in the Chinese. And some people, William West, or Fulbright, and so on, was always talking about the red hordes of Asia will come pouring into Vietnam if you cross the 17th parallel. I didn't believe that. I don't think anybody in Vietnam believed it. But it was a fear that the Chinese would come into the war. I mean, we know now the Chinese had no intention of coming in, no matter what we did. But we weren't that sure at the time, and this is a great specter. You don't know the enemy, you don't know what they're capable of doing, so you can psych people out. And I think that's what happened to them. So I think from that standpoint, what prevented this from happening was exactly that. What will the Chinese do? What will the Russians do? And those who were against it could raise the specter. It'll bring the Russian volunteers into Vietnam by the hundreds of thousands. It'll bring the Chinese in. And boy, have you got a mess on your hands then. So it was a kind of bluff, I think, but we couldn't afford to call the bluff. All right, well, let me just finish up with this. Montaigne has said that there are some defeats that are more triumphant than victories. Now, we can argue that we didn't use the bomb, and therefore this is a defeat for which we should be treated more triumphantly than if we had won. That, to most Americans, of course, sounds like a kind of, I mean, the notion that we could have won the war, but we didn't really want to, and because of the price we'd have to pay, sounds like a kind of loser's rationalization. Actually, I prefer Kipling's remark about some lost cause he was involved in India, that we have 40 million reasons for failure, but we don't have one single excuse. There's a Vietnamese proverb that defeat isn't bitter if you don't swallow it. Victory has 1,000 fathers, but defeat is an orphan. That's from Napoleon. Count Ciano, who is one of the top men in Italy, certainly a man who should know, said later in World War II, victory has 100 memories, but defeat has amnesia. Those of us who went to Vietnam, and I think I really do speak for the 3 million Americans, that is, who went there really with the highest of motives and the best of intentions, and by and large we remain loyal to these ideals. Where we differ today, I think, in sort of degrees of bitterness. The guy who sent me the 16-page fax today from New York because of this one quote in Time magazine this week is an example of a very bitter man. Actually, in many ways, we see the war about the same. It's just that he is so bitter about it, and I'm, I don't know, somehow not bitter. I think it's because, in the Vietnam defeat, I don't really feel that any of us who were there were individually defeated, or that any of us as individuals really failed. Because I really believe that ultimately in life there's only one kind of real failure possible, and that's not being true to yourself. So those of us who went to Vietnam did what we thought was right. We failed in this. As a failure is a kind of abstraction. I don't feel myself that I share any kind of sense of guilt or failure. I did what I thought was right. Didn't turn out, so you win some, you lose some. But maybe that strikes you as being a kind of a loser's rationalization. But the sixth and final judgment then on this is reserved for next week's lecture, which is the aftermath of the Vietnam War. Obviously, one important assessment of any war is what happens after the war and because of the war. And that will be the next two lectures. All right, are there any cleanup matters to be discussed? Anything that I've said here that you want to question or comment on, or anything in last week's lecture? One other, do you all understand this assessment schematic? I mean, how it's, I went into it last week, and I really urge you to try to use this, in part because I think it's going to be one of the questions in the final exam. In taking this method, this schematic, and applying it to some aspect of the war, I think you can apply it to almost any very Olympian aspect or very narrow specific subject. You look at this issue in terms of spirit on both sides or on one side, organizational structure on one side or the other, and the strategy is used on one side. And then the points where these come together are mobilization, leadership, motivation. One person has suggested you could check and turn this sort of clockwise, and the three sides of this then become the points at which these two, which now the corners meet. But I've found this very useful in trying to think through what is otherwise a very nebulous, amorphous, abstract kind of subject. It's a way of, you can put all of these in terms of questions. What was the, on this single issue, what was the leadership position on this? What was the strategy that was used on this? What was the organizational structure? Then you have a way of looking at something in some hard, concrete terms, that otherwise you're just simply wallowing around in a bog of polysyllabic. Right, you're all going home and watching ABC tonight, are you?
Is it at 10 o'clock?
I think it's at 10 o'clock, and then an hour and a half forum at 11:30 to.
What is it, Mr. Peck?
Oh, it's a thing that ABC is having on conjunction with his Time magazine's cover piece on Vietnam, U.S. relations with Vietnam, and Cambodia, the peace process. Peter Jennings has gone there and done a... you understand I'm not pushing. You know how I hate television. Anyway, if you're interested, watch it. I've got to go out to the Naval Air Station in Alameda and give a lecture now on Vietnam war strategy to the people out there. Right. Tomorrow? Oh, okay.
This paper is supposed to be due on May 7th. Do you know? 10 days before the final, right?
Right. This is the university's...
Right. Well, that's a Monday, though. I understand that.
Well, I don't really feel all that strongly about it, but I feel obliged to enforce whatever...
Okay.
I mean, you can't run a railroad without... I'm the engineer, and you say this is what I want you to do. Then it comes.
No, that's.
Well, I've already gotten some papers. Mm-hmm. I should have said that. You know, almost all of them are in. Just a few are not in.
Seriously?
And you would have said how many are in, and I said one. No, but
if.
The psychology is wrong. I mean, you don't want to think deadlines and last minute in writing something like this. I mean, you should try to approach it in a leisurely fashion. But we all do the same thing. I have read papers for conferences, and I find sometimes I try not to do this, and I've gotten better at it. But I'm writing it the night before and finishing it, and before it has to do. So that is a wrong way to do it.
Yeah.
And it does affect the quality. But What I don't know exactly is when grades have to be in.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently they will not allow me to have the papers today and then turn in the grades tomorrow. Even though I guess I could argue, I can read, I'll stay up all night and read these, but they don't think I'm going to, I guess. So anyway, meet their deadline, that's all I can say.
Where would we turn it in?
Well,
Monday, should we just go down to the archive and hand
I've
it
gotten, as I actually I've gotten two. One came in the mail today, but you can mail them to me, or, you know, heaven forbid, give them to me a day ahead of time in class.
Mm-hmm.
So if we couldn't get it done on time and it was late, then we'd get it incomplete, and then.
Well, the way they worked, I taught this course at San Jose, the state university. And there they have a system for incompletes. If the paper doesn't come in, you have to turn in an incomplete, and then they have, I think, a year. In fact, some of these students are just now getting their papers into me. But they're pretty good papers. I mean, they've been working on them for a year. They ought to be.
Right.
Now I have to send a note, a letter to the university because within a certain, I think it was 12 months,